Support for KQED comes from Mancini Sleep World, proud to support a wide variety of local organizations and schools helping address the needs of its local communities. More about the organizations Mancini Sleep World supports at sleepworld.com/donations.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Dropout rates, a widening achievement gap between schools in high and low-income neighborhoods. The conversation around public schools and teachers can often be negative, but veteran Palo Alto English teacher David B. Cohen is trying to counteract some of the pessimism surrounding public education. After observing teachers at over 60 public schools across California, he has documented creativity and innovation at some of the state schools, and we'll talk to Cohen about what he saw, and we'll hear from teachers who will share their classroom practices that engage and inspire. And we want to hear from you, teachers, students, parents. What do you think sparks engagement and learning in the classroom? Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Mindful breathing exercises between lessons, one-on-one chats over lunch, and partnerships between students in California and children in Haiti to foster dialogue around earthquakes. These are just some of the classroom practices longtime Palo Alto teacher David B. Cohen witnessed while visiting classrooms across the state. It's time for an antidote to the toxicity of pessimism and cynicism, Cohen writes about the negative perceptions of public schools. There are many motivated and innovative teachers. And we're going to talk with him this hour about the dedication he saw and hear from teachers who will share classroom practices that both engage and inspire. And we want to hear from you, teachers, students, parents. What do you think sparks engagement and learning in the classroom? Joining us for the hour is David B. Cohen. And again, he's a National Board Certified High School English teacher at Palo Alto High School, author of Capturing the Spark, Inspired Teaching, Thriving Schools. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you, and glad to have some light shed on what is good teaching and also away from, I think, let's talk about your motivation for writing this book. You want to get away from all the negative things that are said about teaching and all the kind of toxicity that seems to sort of take away from the halo of some teachers.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate, and it really can drag people down. The power of negative stories unfortunately seems to outweigh the positive sometimes, and so it seemed necessary to provide a volume of evidence of all the positive things that are out there. And I was fortunate to be in a position working in various teacher leadership projects and building up sort of a network of people I knew about around the state who were doing such inspiring things in education that it sort of reached this boiling point, sort of what am I going to do with all this information? And so that was sort of the inspiration and the motivation.
And it was a search for teachers and probably even people who are, I would assume, critical of the system and critical of education and come down sometimes too hard on teachers, realize that there are dedicated, committed teachers out there. One wonders, you know, how plentiful they are, how many of them are out there. But they're out there, and you discovered them and discovered also some who were really innovative and doing some pretty imaginative and original kinds of things.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it seems like people are ready to take the negative examples and generalize from them and too often see the positive examples as the outliers. And so I wanted to do something about that. And it wasn't too hard by the time I was ready to write the book I had a long list of possible places to visit, people I had met, people I had worked with closely in some cases. And I also took the opportunity to do some visits that had some personal connection for me. So I went back to my old elementary school for a day.
A sentimental journey.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I observed one of my former students, one of my former student teachers who's moved on to a new position in San Diego or outside of San Diego. So that whole combination was it just felt great to be out there. And I got probably the most common reaction when I talked to people out in the field was thank you for doing this, because a lot of teachers feel very beaten down by the negativity.
Well, you did spend about 63 days and talked to 100 teachers and got a lot of this through Kickstarter and a range of schools, right? High-performing schools, some that are struggling, some that are essentially well, you did talk to some charter schools, or I mean, you visited mm-hmm. some charter schools as well, standalone charter schools. So there's a range in diversity here.
Right. I really wanted to get a mix. So, you know, that I'm familiar, most familiar with Palo Alto Unified, which is an affluent community and you know, has a lot, so many advantages, so many things going for it. But I knew I needed to get a wide variety. So I went to some very small schools, alternative schools. I mean, students who are on probation or students who are in an alternative placement, I think we'll hear more about later in the program. Schools in rural communities, schools in the heart of, you know, our largest cities in San Francisco, Oakland, Los Angeles, Fresno.
There's also, of course, a teacher shortage, and I don't want to necessarily go into that, but it behooves us at least to take it under consideration and certainly to put the spotlight on it. I'm wondering how many of these teachers who, because this has always been, you know, a raw subject, these teachers who you found who were performing well and inspiring and providing sparks for students were tenured?
I think most of them, the vast majority. Yeah, tenure is definitely an important piece of it. But like you said, the policy issues, I guess, are less of our focus today. But having some security and some confidence that you can ride out the waves of change. Administrators change over so frequently in so many places. Superintendents change, standards change, politics change. And the sort of the ability to ride things out, have some confidence, and to really be a voice and an advocate for students and for teaching and for the classroom, regardless of how it plays in the school board or with the administration, is really important for teachers.
Talking to David B. Cohen, he's here with us in studio, and he's a Palo Alto High School English teacher who went out and talked, as you've heard, to many teachers and came away optimistic. He wrote a book about it, too, called Capturing the Spark, Inspired Teaching, Thriving Schools. You think a lot of this negativity that you talk about, that you wanted to find a countervailing narrative for, has to do with the shortage of teachers?
Well, I think the shortage of teachers is one result of the negativity that's out there. And the negativity is totally understandable and in some ways warranted. I mean, we're talking about our future here as a society, as a community. We're talking about the futures of our own children and students. And there are problems. And so I don't mean to minimize them when I talk about education generally.
But you put more weight on the resources and the underfunding, don't you?
Yeah, at the end of the book, I try to take a more of a policy angle, sort of, you know, for readers who have stuck with me for 14 chapters, I think it is worth taking the 15th chapter and say there are some things that we can do to protect and strengthen public education. It's not enough to start to just have these positive stories and feel better about it. We need to have the positive stories, feel better about what it is that we're protecting and hopefully improving.
That's really the topic here, and I'd like to afford listeners an opportunity to join in. And let me do that now, because I know there are many teachers, students, and parents who really have strong opinions, not only about what constitutes good teaching, but just the importance of what kind of teachers make a difference and spark young people, and how perhaps your own experience in observing or teaching or being a student, parent, ties in with what you believe really can enhance public education, very important, obviously, and central topic to our lives and futures. You can join us, and you can do that by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, and please feel free to join the program now. It, again, is toll-free to do so, 866-733-6786. There are other ways, of course, that you can become part of this conversation. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And again, I'd like to hear perhaps from listeners, and we'll hear some examples in just a moment from our guest, of what do you find out there that really works and really inspires and is a major catalyst to learning. So let me just get right off the top of your head, David B. Cohen, you know, what kinds of things you write about here that are particularly inspiring?
Well, I took something away from every visit that I did. And, you know, some of them, I think to break it down in a somewhat more manageable way, elementary schools were always the most fun. I think just being around the little kids is, just seeing the joy on their face when the teacher announces that the color of the day is blue, in Lois Johnson's transitional kindergarten class in Grass Valley. It was so fun. You just take so much energy from the elementary kids. The middle schools, I think, surprised me the most, just in terms of how they've, I think they've changed since I was in middle school a long time ago. And I found myself with my own sons being in middle school at the time I was working on the book, maybe more attuned and more interested in a way. And I took something away from the middle schools that I hadn't expected. I was sort of drawn to them in a way I didn't anticipate. And then high schools, I always felt like I had left something undiscovered, especially with large high schools. There's so much interesting stuff going on with students learning things as diverse as interesting agricultural and culinary skills and technological skills and bioengineering, the things they're doing in high schools today in biotechnology, for example. And all sorts of really creative interdisciplinary projects and research. So the high schools were always really invigorating, but I always left feeling like I had missed something too.
Well, we'll talk with some teachers, and we're going to do that shortly. I just want to ask you one other thing, though. Richard Larkin is kind of a mentor and a hero of yours, I believe. Is that right?
I think Richard Lakin.
I mean, Lakin, excuse me. Yeah, without him.
Yeah.
He's a guy who writes about love and how important love is in
Richard wrote a book called Teaching as an Act of Love, and he reached out to me. He worked and lived in Connecticut for a long time and moved to Jerusalem and reached out to me because I was blogging about education, and he had just self-published a teaching memoir called Teaching as an Act of Love. And we struck up a bit of a correspondence over the years.
I read an excerpt of that. I was struck by it, but I was also struck by, he emphasizes authenticity, and I think that's very important in any kind of pedagogy you're teaching. But love, that's a kind of tough word to use about teaching. I mean, in fact, I wonder, some people may recoil when they hear that because they want teachers to be distant but also to be, affectionate and certainly accessible and all. But love is a pretty strong word to use.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's essential to be attuned to that and also to recognize that love looks different in different
situations.
Some
students are hard to love,
Oh, they are. They are. But that's our job, is to find what it is we love about them or about their potential or about our opportunity to help them. And love can look tough and stern, but when it's backed up and, like you said, when it's authentic and students know the reason you're being tough and the reason that you care and the reason you're setting some firm limits, if those are students who need firm limits, then I think it works. And so love doesn't have to look completely touchy-feely. Love can be, I care so much about you that I am going to provide the structure and support that you need to meet some high expectations.
Now, there's a very touching moment in a film, which I would recommend. I thought it was a terrific film called A Man Called Ovi. It's a Swedish film, and the man's wife, I'm not going to give away too much of the plot here, but she's a teacher, and somehow she reaches this student who's really quite troubled and everything and suddenly inspires him. And there's that moment, you realize that kind of magic can happen. Let me bring some callers on and find out what they have to say. Sam, you're up first here. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hi. I think one thing is the point is that I'd like to make is I think that blaming teachers for everything that's wrong with public schools is an incredibly malinformed and just kind of ignorant opinion. Number two, I just have to say, as a product of the Oakland Public Schools from kindergarten all the way through high schools, I can recall numerous examples. And actually, just to speak on the love topic, I remember I was a bit of a chatty child, spent a lot of time in the principal's office, but in third grade I had a teacher, Miss Matsuoka, that was kind of stood about 4'11" and was very strict and very stern with me, and as opposed to other teachers who kind of expected kids to just kind of be quiet and sit with their hands folded across their desk, she respected my intelligence, but when she thought I'd crossed the line, sent me to the principal's office. But I never ever doubted that she cared for me and that she was doing what she did because she respected me and that she really cared for me. And then lastly, a question is, why does your guest feel that teachers have become such a convenient scapegoat for everything that's wrong with the public schools?
Thank you for that call, Sam. You want to opine on that, David Bicon?
Well, sure. I think it's the proximity. You know, if the concern that we have about students and what they've learned, what they're able to do when they emerge from school, then the first place you look is the teacher. The teacher has the direct contact and the direct responsibility. But unfortunately, we miss some of the wisdom that people understand in other venues. They understand it when you read the sports section. They understand it when you look at business. They understand it in so many other spheres, but we're not willing to, it seems, to apply it as much in education. And that is that the teachers operate within a context that's largely beyond their control. And the administrators, to some, they have more control, but their hands are tied in many ways too. And so there's really a system-wide problem. And to the extent that critics of public education want to focus on teachers, Sam is exactly right that the focusing on the teachers is really missing the point, because if you have a system that's – if you have a system, and I'm not conceding that we do, but if we have a system that's continually producing disappointing results or disappointing effectiveness from the people working in it, then at some point you have to look at the system and stop blaming the people who have been sort of controlled and constrained by that system.
No, I quite agree with you, though one of the reasons, I suppose, California went test crazy for so long was the difficulty of finding metrics to gauge how well teachers are doing in the classroom or what kind of success they're having, and that makes for easier scapegoating, I suppose. Let me thank the caller. We're going to go to more calls here, but first I want to bring in one of the teachers that David spoke to over the course of his odyssey, Marciano Gutierrez, who's a history teacher at Alta Vista High School in Mountain View. Good to have you aboard here, Marciano. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
I was talking before about a movie I saw called A Man Called Ove and A Troubled Youth, and I think it's probably an apt characterization to say that many of the young people you work with could be characterized as troubled youth.
I think that description is appropriate. I teach at a school that serves students where each of them have been removed from the traditional high school, some for behavioral issues, some for attendance. A lot of times kids come to us simply because the stress at the big comprehensive schools is just too much for them. And so, yes, I think that description is fair.
So is there a way of getting through to these students in general, or is it case by case?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the curriculum that's taught. The majority of students that I teach are students of color, and the majority of them are students who are Latino or Mexican-American. And so I try to teach a curriculum where they see themselves every single day in every single unit. And so it's beyond just teaching Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, but also teaching about the Chicano walkouts of the 1960s, or the Zoot Suit riots of World War II, or the Mexican-American fighter pilots, so that students know that they're just not witnessing history, but that people who look like them, who had stories similar to them, were active in history. I got to tell you that probably the best memory I have of teaching is when a student told me that she never thought or she never learned about this, and that she didn't think that she would learn about this anywhere else but in my classroom.
Well, you mentioned mostly things related to Latino identity, and you say you teach students of color. Are they, for the most part, preponderantly Latino backgrounds?
Yes. Yes, the majority of them are Latinos, and the majority are Latino males. However, I do teach a variety of students. And so even though we are predominantly Mexican, Mexican-American, we also have quite a few other students. And I make sure to include the students of who are disabled, stories of that, students who are Filipino talking about their diversity and what they've contributed to our society as well. In addition to teaching just what I'm supposed to teach generally about history.
You also go to their homes, though, I understand. Is that right?
Absolutely. So at Alta Vista High School, we try to bridge the gap between family life and school life. And we understand that, you know, we are only with them so many hours of the day, that there are other things in their lives that have taken place that are causing them to be at our school. And so we do home visits to try to make sure that the parents who often don't have very, you know, very positive relations with the school see us as partners, not as someone who is trying to do something to their kid, but rather help their student. And we've even changed things like our parent-teacher conferences. I'm not sure if you've ever been to one of those, but normally it's going into a teacher's classroom and just having a quick chat about a student's progress. What we've done is we've identified students who are the most high risk, the most at need. We bring parents, the students, the family, and every single staff member meets around a table, and we identify the problems that are standing in the way of the student's success. We develop an action plan to try to address those concerns and then even have a follow-up mechanism. So we don't see school and family as separate. We see them as equal partners in the student life.
And I should mention, you are also the son of undocumented immigrants. Is that correct?
I am, actually. So my father is an undocumented immigrant from Oaxaca, Mexico. And my mother was an individual who struggled in school. She before she passed away, she read at a third grade level. And so I share this story with my kids. In fact, the very first thing that students learn is about me, and not to have me be the center of attention, but rather to share my story, to show kids that the person standing in front of them in class is someone who understands their story. And I think me having a similar background as them helps bridge that gap between their home life and my classroom.
Marciano Gutierrez, again, is a history teacher at Alta Vista High School in Mountain View, and we really appreciate your being with us, Marciano. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
You too. And let me read some comments that are coming in. Robert writes, let's put this discussion in the context of the new administration, with an education secretary hostile to public education, strongly supporting a shift in funds from public to private education. And the answer to how to engage students, or one answer, comes from a listener named David, who says, engagement and excitement happen when teachers are trained and supported to follow the child. Personalized learning, while a new buzzword, happens when and where students have the freedom to learn at their own pace. Create learning environments that allow students to explore their passions and individuality. Wondering also, David Cohen, we're coming up on a break here, but did you find more student-centered teachers were outstanding and inspiring and creating a spark, or were they more teacher-centered as opposed to student-centered? I know these are kind of broad dichotomies, but there
sure.
are. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, both can be effective depending on the context, and but I think there needs to be a balance. You can't have everything be student-driven and student-initiated if they don't have some shared understanding and knowledge to work from. Knowing something is what leads to more curiosity. I think being curious without knowledge wouldn't necessarily work. And at the same time, if it's always teacher-centered, you're going to lose kids. And so, you know, I was mostly seeing teachers for a single day, and so it would be hard to overgeneralize. But, yeah, some balance.
We're coming up on a break, but did you have an impression, Ben wants to know, any impressions from parents across the state? Do they generally want their children to be challenged, or were they more worried about getting good grades?
That wasn't really in the scope of my visits to talk with parents, unless they happened to be the teachers I was visiting.
Of course, you could tell from what the teachers tell you, I suspect.
Sure, yeah. I think parents always...
They generally want their kids to do well, yeah.
Yeah, but
grades
are part of that.
We'll hear from some of them, I'm sure. We'll hear from some more teachers, and we'll continue our discussion with David B. Cohen, whose book is called Capturing the Spark, Inspired Teaching, Thriving Schools, and we'll hear from more of you as well. So stay on the line if you're on the line. You're listening to Forum, and you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support comes from Marin Community Foundation, proud sponsor of KQED's Forum. For those with a profound commitment to charitable giving, MCF has created Virtuoso. Virtuoso is the modern alternative to a private foundation, customized to your specific needs. So if you're looking to enjoy more independence, concierge service from a team of experts, and maximum financial benefits, Virtuoso from MCF may be the solution you need. Learn more at marincf.org. Support also comes from the Asia Foundation, proud sponsor of KQED's Forum. Announcing their newly released Survey of the Afghan People 2016, the broadest nationwide survey of Afghan attitudes and opinions. The survey provides deep insight into issues central to the country's development. Online at asiafoundation.org.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and it's clear to parents and students certainly alike that good teaching matters, but debates continue to rage over which policies and practices work best in the classroom. Veteran Palo Alto teacher David Cohen is here with us talking about, well, the fact that he visited classrooms across the state to witness firsthand how over 75 teachers are engaging their students, and we're talking about what sparked them, and in fact, he wrote a book about it called Continuing the Spark. I want to go to a caller, and let me bring in a listener from Oakland. Susanna, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I have been teaching for 25 years, and I do want to say, before I just ask my question really quickly, I think a lot of teaching is about stage presence. No matter what you're teaching, whether it's math or art or third grade, a lot of it is how just how you are, how you come across to the class, and that can vary from day to day. It's hard to be on 100% of the time.
As a teacher of even longer, I would have your number of years, I would have to agree with you. But I also bring in energy, don't you think? I mean, the two are tied together.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had a friend who wasn't a teacher who once observed to me, what the student is really learning is you. How do you move through space? Are you organized? How do you negotiate conflict? You know, how do you just deal with the hundreds of things that happen in the course of a day or a school year? And a lot of it is true, and I try to be aware of that, but you can't be totally self-aware every single moment. I do make the effort. But the kind of matter I wanted to bring up, and as I say, I've been teaching for quite a long time, is the intrusion of cell phones into the classroom. I teach high school, and they are ubiquitous, and I often feel that I'm doing things that are very compelling and interesting and hands-on and engaging, and yet I cannot get them to put away their cell phones. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about that, because it's really, really changed the landscape of teaching.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. One of the things to do is with each class, say, put away your cell phones, turn them off, just to remind them, because it's almost habitual, or, I mean, it is a habit-forming thing. David, want to shed some light on that from your many years of teaching?
Yeah, as a fellow high school teacher, I can relate to that. There, there's different approaches. Some teachers have actually encouraged cell phone use and said, we've got a powerful search engine in kids' hands, and so if something happens in the class that inspires them to look something up, then they should go ahead and do that and share with the class and the teacher what they're doing. But just as a distraction, that is an issue. I think there are strategies that put that away, and then to some extent
you start shaming a student, and then the student will say, "Yeah, but I'm looking at the text because I couldn't afford to buy the book or something like
right.
that."
Right. So yeah, there are some legitimate reasons, and I think another thing is we need to consider the landscape has changed, and we need to compete in a sense. We need a teacher I observed, Heather Wolpert Guerin, is one I write about in the book, and she's very aware of that her English language arts lessons need to be compelling and engaging and demanding and well-paced enough that students aren't their minds aren't drifting. They're not going to be as likely to reach for a distraction.
A couple of comments I want to read here, and this comment is almost musical to me, to my ears. Mary comments, I've been teaching English in a high school classroom for 20 years and still wake up every morning excited to go to work. What sustains me is not only love for my students, but also passion for my subject, literature. When you're in love, you want to tell the world. Another listener comments, schools, please provide more project-based learning. The best teachers and classrooms in Oakland did this, especially in fourth and fifth grade. One of our son's most demanding teachers used the model. It was also his most rewarding experience. And speaking about fifth grade and projects, I wanted to bring another teacher on here. That's Cammie Walker, who is a fifth grade teacher at Murdy Elementary School in Garden Grove. That's in Orange County, and she joins us by phone. And Cammie Walker, welcome to the Forum program this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much, Michael. Good morning, Dave.
Thank you. And you have that up, energetic voice that's buoyant and the students can respond to. I also want to talk about, so I've been reading about your work and it's fascinating, having them make Play-Doh out of essentially flour, water, and salt, and then make better Play-Doh after they've made the Play-Doh.
It's very true that I have embraced engineering in my classroom. And this wasn't always so. I'm an elementary teacher, and I teach multiple subjects. And so as I was researching Next Generation Science Standards and saw the word engineering, my first response was what a lot of other teachers were, engineering what? How can they expect us to take this on? But I am not one to shy away from a challenge. I wanted to try it and see. And when I tried it, what I found is that it is one of the most engaging ways to make kids care about what they're learning. And the example that you are citing, I'm sure, is from the CTA magazine. And what I did there was take an engineering as elementary lesson and modified it for fifth grade standards, which are that we take a look at things that cannot necessarily be seen in the world, but matter that really exists. And then I had my kids teach kindergarten and first grade that have very similar standards. So engineering allowed my kids not only to become students, but to become teachers and learners and become those engineers.
Yeah, the kind engineering, I mean, you went right to the E in the STEM in terms of your teaching. And I think it's been certainly very useful the way you've used it. Let me ask about another example that I read in that same article you just referenced, where you were actually having kids talk about, well, the earthquake in Haiti and making connections to young people in Haiti and actually rebuilding some of the sort of obviously smaller scale models of buildings and houses that were essentially destroyed in the earthquake.
Yeah, this was really, Michael, my first introduction to engineering. And what I did is took a look at Northridge, which was my alma mater, Cal State Northridge, and the earthquake that happened there, which was almost exactly the same magnitude as the earthquake in Haiti, and very similar time frames. They were about a year between each other. So I presented the kids the picture of Northridge and the little bit of destruction, and I also told them in the photo that, isn't it sad, 25 people less than 2 hours from our homes perished in this earthquake. And the kids were like, yeah, and they felt really, really bad. And then I showed them the absolute devastation in Haiti. And then when we researched and recognized over 250,000 people perished and that 400,000 people were still homeless, and this is a discussion that happened 4 years after the earthquake, there was no O's and too bad. The room was silent. And that was my engagement factor. And then we went from there and we followed the engineering design process of what could we do? What was different in comparing Northridge to Haiti? And we determined that the buildings and the structural foundation and the building codes, that laws are really good for us, that laws are sometimes meant for safety and protection. So the kids went on to make models and to test models on an earthquake machine that is very, very easy to make. My husband made mine, but there are actual plans through Engineering as Elementary. And they found out that they had a little bit of power in creating something that made a difference. And I'm telling you, the first time, every single model failed. 100% failed. And this is where I found the power of engineering, Michael. Because in that failure, I expected, and I've seen before, when a kid fails, they want to quit. It's like, oh, no, no. When they failed, it was like, okay, my plan A didn't work. What can I do? Let's go to plan B. And if I have to, I'll go to plan C and D. And then it was like a metamorphosis in that my kids were not doing this in class. I mean, I'm an elementary teacher. I have multiple subjects. We couldn't do this every day. So they're like, can we please take this home and work on it at home, and then we'll come back and test it? And this happened to be very close to Christmas break. What am I going to say? No, you can't do this at home. So, of course, they took it home. They revised their plans. They worked together. They Skyped together. They got on different, you know, things. I use Padlet a lot, which is a communication forum where they can talk to each other in a very safe way. And then they brought their buildings back. They tested them. It didn't work. They tested them again. They became those engineers. They were so excited. And I can tell you, 3 weeks after we started, 100% of them had succeeded. And that's where I thought.
Wow, it's quite a story. And it's a story that can in itself inspire in terms of the way young people can become sparked and engaged. And I know you work with a lot of other things with bracelets in that Haiti exchange and with teaching kids about germs and teaching them about water filtration, everything. You're doing a lot of good work, and you can learn more about it in David's book. And I appreciate your being with us, and I thank you and commend you. That's Cammy Walker, who is a fifth-grade teacher at Murdy Elementary School in Garden Grove, Orange County. And just a comment here from Jessica, one of our listeners, who says, get students involved in their curriculum. Project-based learning is the closest thing to solving real problems outside of academia. It teaches kids to work in teams, which we just heard, manage their time, research, problem solve, present their findings, and teach others. David?
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to add one reason that I was excited to visit Cammy is that her work is also an example of how our unions are supporting better teaching. Cammy's project came to my attention because she was sharing it because it was funded through a grant from the Institute for Teaching, which is a nonprofit branch of the California Teachers Association that's dedicated to teacher-driven change, and they do some outstanding work.
That's a nice plug for the unions. Here's some more comments I'm going to read before I go.
It's a whole chapter in the book, too. I mean, it wasn't hard to find examples of unions supporting better teaching.
Here's a couple of comments I want to get to. They have to do with policy, and then I'll get to more of your calls. Kevin writes, desegregating California schools would really help. Kind of hard to limit one's cynicism in view of an early 21st century Jim Crow revival. We did a whole program on that, by the way, which I would commend you to listen to. Stacy writes, after volunteering at my son's school for a year, I've concluded that people attending to our children 5 days a week for 10 hours a day should be earning no less than $100,000 annually. They deserve compensation that affords a comfortable life and attracts the best candidates for the jobs. And let me go, indeed, to more of your calls. We'll go to Sonoma and welcome Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a librarian that works with teens and classroom teachers, and it's been such a rewarding part of my work as a public librarian. And I'm wondering if your guest can speak to his experiences with using the public library or the school library in his work, or if it features in his book at all.
David?
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you called. I love libraries, love librarians, and one of the policy recommendations I made at the end of the book is that's specific to California is that we have got to address our shortage of libraries and librarians, worst in the nation in that regard. And libraries that are open and well-stocked with physical books, people still enjoy them and read them, but also that are comfortable spaces and pleasant and lively places. That they're the hubs of learning, and the librarians are the one teacher on a campus generally who has the responsibility for meeting the educational needs of every student and supporting all of the teachers on campus. And we just can't support libraries enough. I had a chance to visit a few librarians. I'll just give a quick shout out to Kay Hones, who's right here in San Francisco. She works in multiple secondary school libraries, and she's a fantastic asset to this city and to the school district here. And Sarah Morgan, another librarian, she was at Merced High School at the time I visited her, and did some really outstanding projects involving oral history that created partnerships between the University of California, the local community and local library, and the school library and history classes.
Let me thank Rachel for her call. I want to get another caller on here. And Andrew, that's you. You're on. Morning.
Hi, Michael. Hi. First of all, I just kind of want to say I'm a little upset the way you said, you know, few good teachers are maybe hard to find. I don't think this is a teacher problem at all. It's a policy and a cultural problem. Started with, you know, Reagan, but the public education system has been systematically dismantled and replaced with a private education system for a class of people who are earning more and more money. I think it's time that we start seriously considering abolishing private education, or at least taxing it to a point where it just can't be sustainable for most people. The only reason public education doesn't have resources is because people with money and communities don't buy in. People moving to Oakland right now are these extremely wealthy, upper-middle-class white people who grew up upper-middle-class, and now they have a lot more money than they did before because they're privately educated and they've had their life trajectory was set in motion. And I think that is seriously the problem we have to consider here, is that private education is eroding any possibility of a decent public education system. And that's it. That's my comment.
Well, I thank you for your comment. By the way, I wasn't necessarily saying there aren't good teachers out there. I was saying it's difficult to find really inspiring teachers. I mean, like you're talking about here. There are a lot of good teachers, dedicated teachers. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure how hard it is. I think, but it wasn't hard for me to find them. And I think to Andrew's point, there are some pretty strong measures advocated in that call, but the underlying issue of inequity is definitely something that needs to be addressed in California. In the closing chapter of my book, I just gave some quick figures comparing similar-sized schools in similar regions or in the same county. And even I was just looking at per pupil funding, the official district budgets, wildly disproportionate. And that's even before you factor in the private money that's donated through foundations in districts like mine, which adds hundreds of thousands of dollars to each school budget in some cases, especially the larger schools.
Let me go to another caller, and we're going to bring another teacher on here in just a moment as well. Let's go to Petaluma. Welcome, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the conversation. My question regards teacher training. I have a kindergartner with a first-year teacher and a good friend who's also a first-year teacher. And I've just been shocked by the amount of training and follow-up and just outside sort of licensing requirements that they have to leave the classroom for on a regular basis. And I know that doesn't end after the second year. So I'm wondering, with all the demands on teachers, do you have any recommendations, especially for new teachers, about how they can be more innovative given all the demands on them?
Well, first year teaching, from my own recollections and from observing people go through it, is it's a gauntlet, unfortunately. And the problems you describe are serious. And I think as far as advice to those teachers, I think probably the key is to have good support, people you can talk to, and people who can sort of bring you through that. I think so many great teachers are very reflective and are aware of the ways in which they need to improve. And when you're new, there are so many ways that you're learning and needing to improve. And so I think it's important to validate that and help beginning teachers focus on manageable amounts of the transition and to also see their success.
And Julie, thank you for the call. Actually, Christina wants to know, she says she's curious, how have David's observations informed his own teaching practice?
There were probably two things. I think one was it renewed a sense of the importance of personalizing the experience and being fully present for kids and trying to be to take more advantage of the downtime and the in-between times to just speak with people, just relate in a non-academic sense and show some sense of connection and caring. And then probably the other most specific change to my teaching was more of a technological one that I adopted from a teacher named Jennifer Roberts, who wrote a book about using technology in the classroom, especially if you have a one-to-one program, which means every student has their own laptop or Chromebook. And because of her, I started using a blog as a sort of a daily journal and a way of recording what's the lesson for the day. And so it's a good routine that makes the lessons accessible later on in a chronological order and also available to parents to see on a daily basis what's happening.
I want to bring Heidi Rodriguez into this. She's also an English teacher. She teaches at Central Union High School in Imperial County. And good to have you with us, Heidi Rodriguez. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And let me find out from you about this whole topic that we have broached about project-based learning. What do you do in the classroom that fits into that category?
I've enjoyed the conversations. I've really gotten a lot out of what the callers and the other teachers and David especially have said. And I got excited every time I'd hear project-based learning because that's what my background is in. And especially now with the Common Core standards, we have a stronger ability to make project-based learning happen in the classrooms. We're very fortunate here in California that I believe we're implementing the Common Core standards in a way that's positive and actually builds kids' thinking. And I say kids, even though I work with high school students. But one of the, for example, I'm actually teaching English now, AVID and journalism. But I'm a history teacher. That's what my background is in. And what I have my students do is participate in the C-SPAN student cam competition. And that is one of many projects that we do in class. But what I really like about that is that it's public, right? So the students, they actually have an audience other than the teacher, other than their classmates, other than the school, where their work is being critiqued by someone that they don't know. And I think that's really important for them because, one, they have a problem. They have a problem that they have to solve. They really have to use that part of their brain. They have to research. You know, we hear about the critical abilities from the Common Core standards. They have to analyze information, right? And so as I build the scaffolds in for them to be able to do this research in these projects, it's up to them. We were talking about student choice, and this is where they have freedom because they choose a topic that they're interested in, a topic that they're passionate about, but within structure, as David mentioned. They experiment with their information. I've had students who have actually, going with the previous teacher that was talking about the iterative process, I have students that have actually worked on their videos about four or five times because it was born out of them to make it better, right? And these are, I think, the skills. Well, I don't think. I know these are the skills that employers want. They want young people to be able to go in and solve problems, to take pride in their work. I want my students to be competitive. Imperial County doesn't have a lot of opportunities for students in the way that maybe a place like Palo Alto does. But I want them to be able to say, you know what, I'm ready to work at Google. I'm ready to work at Microsoft because I'm a problem solver and I can think, I can be successful in college because of these skills.
Well, I wish you good luck and good tidings to follow. And I certainly appreciate your letting us know how you do this and how you make that connection between especially the workplace and what may be offered in the workplace. I know that down there in Imperial County, as you said, there aren't as many opportunities. So you're getting the students engaged and you're doing it in innovative ways. And I thank you for sharing with us.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Salton Sea, I just want to add to this. Three of our students who were recent immigrants from Mexico, they actually submitted their C-SPAN project. One placed third nationally, and their video was used a lot to bring attention to the Salton Sea, which is down here in this area.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So for them to be able to have that impact with what they're learning and what they're doing on their community and the country is huge.
Yeah, and it certainly makes a difference in their lives. Thank you so much. That's Heidi Rodriguez again, who is English teacher at Central Union High School in Imperial County. Here's Christina, who says, it's shocking to see how much playtime has been taken away from kids. In conversations with our occupational therapy teacher, we learned that increasingly kids aren't gaining the physical skills they need to write because those motor skills are strengthened through play. And another listener writes, we had teachers who cared to make sure that we got home after school and on occasion would even drive us home. It's amazing that today we teachers can't take that step because of the potential liability and mistrust in our system today. Also important points. And let me get a caller on. Jordan, that's you. Who's next? Thanks for waiting.
Thank you.
Jordan, are you
hi.
There? Yeah, hi.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about culturally responsive teaching. But first, just addressing that last comment about driving kids home. I know, you know, there is a liability there, but I do want to say that a lot of that still happens, both picking up to bring to school and also taking to school. But culturally responsive teaching, I learned about this from Dr. Zaretta Hammond, who's a Bay Area educator, is about a teacher recognizing the cultural capital and tools of a student already and then building a lesson based upon what you know about your students. So this is really addressing this idea of how do we foster these personal relationships with kids, and I think that all comes from addressing, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs for physiological needs, safety needs, love and belonging and esteem before we actually get to have that trusting relationship. So, for example, I know in my classroom at the beginning of the year, I ask my students, again, this is based on work by Dr. Zaretta Hammond, what are you listening to? What are you watching? What makes you mad? And what are the unique cultural events happening in your life right now? And one of the things as an Oakland teacher that came out from that was people are watching and obsessed with the Warriors. So as an Algebra 2 teacher, my first lesson about parabolas, we actually watched videos of Steph Curry shooting basketballs, and we took videos of ourselves shooting basketballs, and we mapped that trajectory of the basketball to learn about the vertex of a parabola. And so I think it's, you know, important how can we actually learn what it is that our students really are interested in. We see a lot of these videos of, you know, teachers making rap videos or having students making rap videos, and while that can be culturally responsive, it's not actually culturally responsive unless we're sure that those are the things our students are interested in.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for those comments, and I appreciate your calling. I want to get to another caller here while we have time, and that's Morgan. Morgan, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you so much. First, I want to thank you for the conversation. It's so nice to hear talk of not the terrible teachers who are destroying our students, but the wonderful teachers who are lifting them up. But at the same time, that comes with a concern. And my concern is that when we talk about the top 5% of the profession, we create this idea that all teachers should be held to those standards. You know, Arne Duncan has said that a good teacher can completely turn around the lives of all the kids in their care. And holding ourselves to that standard, you know, as you said yourself, Michael, that there's so many good teachers out there who aren't transformational, but they're good, they're solid, they're wonderful. And when we present the idea that they should be held to the standard of the top 5%, it's detrimental to the profession as a whole. I'd rather see us talking more about how can we value and support all our teachers and create structures for them all to succeed, regardless of where they are on the bell curve of ability.
Well, I thank you, Morgan, for that call, and I just want to read another comment from Mondo, who says, for 16 years, I subbed in the San Francisco Unified School District, primarily at difficult middle schools. I was a go-to sub because I had presence plus a sense of humor. Both are needed, especially at middle school level. I think sense of humor is important as well, and thank you for that comment. And thank you, David Cohen, for spending this hour with us. David B. Cohen, again, is a Palo Alto High School English teacher. His book is called Capturing the Spark, Inspired Teaching, Thriving Schools. You're going to continue with this and study more teachers and find more inspiring teachers?
You know, this project took a lot out of me. And at some point, I hope to find opportunities to continue work like it, but I'm not sure what form that will take yet.
Well, good luck to you. Appreciate you spending this time with us. We're actually going to talk in the next hour to another teacher, Peter Orner, who has a book out, who's also a fiction writer. And his book is a kind of combination memoir and literary spotlight on different writers. And also a lot of personal things, so stay tuned for that. That's up ahead. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.
Hi, I'm Michelle Hennigan here with Bud Gundy. And Bud, it's the gift-giving season, but when is it great not to get a gift?
When you make a pledge to KQED and you file an itemized return.
That's right. You only have until midnight on December 31st to make a donation that you can claim on your taxes for 2016.
So keep some of your federal tax dollars right here in California by helping KQED and give yourself another deduction come April. Make a pledge now at kqed.org/donate.